This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The following Rustic Exhibition requires discretionary viewer participation.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 18 of Greetings from Allentown. I'm your host, Peter Winson. And today, we're going to be taking a look at, and I'm going to pause right here, WCW, as you might have been able to tell from that theme. I got to tell you, the WCW gets made fun of quite a lot, but the intros to their shows were always rather fun. There were a lot of fun WCW themes for the shows. There, of course, there's the old World Championship Wrestling theme on TBS. And this one for Main Event, I love because it's, you know, kind of action-packed there for about 20 seconds. And then you have that pause, and then at the end, dung. Of course, Main Event was a show that came about around the time of Clash 1. I believe they debuted it the Sunday after the first Clash of the Champions, and they were promoting it on the Clash of the Champions as kind of being a show that would be a little bit different than your normal weekend show, that they would have more high-profile matches, which did last for a couple of weeks, as these things tend to happen, like with WWF Shotgun Saturday Night and the nightclub. You have an idea, and it doesn't really work out for one reason or another, so they kind of back away from it. But this show managed to survive for many, many years and did not actually go away until January of 1998, when it kind of made way for Thunder, which was going to be coming to TBS on Thursday, and you could eliminate a show at that point because WCW obviously had more programming than they knew what to do with at that time. But right now we're talking about WCW 1990, and yes, technically it is World Championship Wrestling by December 23rd, 1990, which is the time that this aired, as the NWA name had more or less been dropped, as the the wise men at World Championship Wrestling finally came to the realization of, hey, the NWA is basically just us at this point, so why do we have to go and ask permission for other people to do title changes and all that business? So they just decided to go with the World Championship Wrestling name. Really starting at Starrcade, this is the second episode of Main Event that was labeled WCW Main Event. 2 weeks earlier, it was labeled NWA Main Event. So I'm kind of going off that as my basis here. Of course, let me get in some quick plugs real quick. You know that the show is on the Pro Wrestling Only feed as part of the Place to Be Nation, and I could not be happier about that because a lot more people have been listening to the program and I've been getting a lot more feedback. Much of it positive. In fact, I almost kind of want to get negative feedback from somebody. And I said that to my wife. I was like, I'm kind of blown away by people liking my podcast. And she's like, well, I'll tell you. If you want somebody to tell you that they hate your podcast, I think it stinks. But that's just my wife being wise with me. You can reach the show on Twitter at GF Allentown Pod, on Facebook at GF Allentown. You can search it out somewhere. Those of you who follow on Facebook who were watching very closely on Friday afternoon, notice that I was trying to post a poll for a future show and kept trying and failing, which is one of my Facebook foibles, is I have no idea how to post a poll on there. Maybe I'll figure it out by the time this show is released. But in fairness to me, I was posting it literally on my phone and not even in the Facebook app. I was using the web application in Chrome and trying to do it that way. And I'm literally riding in a car on the way to the Jimmy Carter Library in Atlanta. So yes, I was actually in Atlanta this past weekend, as I referenced at the end of last week's show. And because I'm a giant history nerd who likes to go to presidential libraries, even though in theory I hate them because they're all taxpayer kind of funded and whatnot, Jimmy Carter Library was the first place my friend and I went to when we landed in Atlanta, because we got there at 9:30 in the morning and you can't check into the hotel, which was way out in Sandy Springs, Georgia, which is in the north kind of perimeter of the greater Atlanta area. It was down there at SunTrust Field for the Braves and the Mets, really just kind of supporting my friend who I hadn't seen in a few years in his Mets fandom. And he managed to get a ball from the bullpen guy at Friday night's game. The bullpen catcher threw my 38-year-old friend a baseball to effectively thank him for ratting out the person who reported somebody threw a paper airplane into the Mets bullpen. And what happened was he kind of reported it on the app, and they were looking up in the stands to figure out who it was. And my friend was kind of doing that nod thing of like, it was the guy behind me. And they actually noticed that the bullpen coach for the Mets, who I think his name is Bonus, maybe it's Ricky Bonus or whatever, shows that I didn't do a really good job cosplaying a Mets fan, since I don't even know who the who the bullpen coach is. But in any event, yeah, so they throw him a ball, and then the Mets proceeded to lose in the bottom of the ninth to the Braves. A nice little ballpark there out in the suburbs of Atlanta. I'm not so sure it was a wise idea to kind of move it away from the city center, although there are certain things about the city of Atlanta that I don't quite understand that was being explained to me. There were certain racial issues, like I didn't quite understand it, because I've only been to Atlanta outside of the airport anyway twice. And I was hoping to get over to Center Stage Theater to see what it looked like, to see if I could perhaps mail a letter from Center Stage, literally. Of course, Letters from Center Stage, another fine show on the Pro Wrestling Only feed that you should check out. Though I do know that from listening to Chris Zellner's podcast in the past, he, of course, a resident of Georgia, I know that he has said that Center Stage, not exactly in the greatest area of Atlanta. He might have been referring to that area from like the 90s, but I kind of looked at it on Google Maps, and it didn't look like there was any real place to park. So my friend and I, instead, on Sunday, we went to Centennial Olympic Park and just kind of walked around there and roasted, because it was quite warm on that day. Oh, I kind of got sidetracked. You want to get the email into me? Greetings from Allentown at gmail.com. You can send your hate mail that way. At some point, if I were to get enough emails or questions or Q&A, I would do something like a mailbag show. I have no idea how that would even work or what I would do with it, but I'd probably come up with some sort of format as I go along. So this is the second show with it as WCW, and I kind of explained why they dropped the NWA name. But you know, when you're younger, sometimes you don't know these things and you invent them in your head to kind of explain why certain things happened. Like, around the same time period, the basketball player Hakeem Olajuwon, he used to be known as Akeem Olajuwon with no H. And the way I explained it to myself was that he was so mortified by the fact that the WWF had a character named Akeem, who was a 450-pound white man jiving and shucking and making fun of Dusty Rhodes, that he added the H to his name just to distance himself from that character. And of course, that's not true. It has to do with Hakeem, I guess, in the native language in Olajuwon's home country of Nigeria. It means something like wise man or doctor or something like that. And the same here. I actually thought that they had dropped the NWA name to distance themselves from the then popular rap group NWA, which I cannot say the name of it because I don't want to get in trouble like Bill Maher did on his HBO show a couple of weeks ago. And so they went with WCW, and that was my theory of why that happened, which of course is not true. Now, for WCW in the year 1990 was kind of a missed opportunity year, since WWF had slid back a bit during the year with the Ultimate Warrior in the top spot from Hulk Hogan for much of the spring and summer. Although this is not entirely the fault of WCW, because you did have a Sting injury that they had to work around, but in fact, they did make some of the same errors in booking and a lot of other things that they had made 2 years before in 1988. For example, in 88, they just kind of let Ray Traylor, Big Bubba Rogers, walk out the door and into the WWF's arms, which gave them a qualified heel big man for Hulk Hogan to work against in 1988, and thus... And then you have 2 years later here, you have The Undertaker, Mark Calloway, Mean Mark Callis leaving, which was kind of a signal that maybe they were not using the talents that they had on hand to their full potential. And that would happen on both the heel and the babyface side, such as on the babyface side, Brian Pillman, forever underutilized in this era of WCW. He's actually on this program here today. And, of course, the heel side of it, because they were so limited, it caused issues with the Sting world title reign, which I did talk about a bit in one of my older articles on section309.com, where I wrote about Sting in the year 1990. Of course, he missed about 4 months with the knee injury after Clash 10, but he was done no favors after he won the world title from Ric Flair in July. And the difference between that and the WWF, where they put Warrior on top because Hogan was going to go make a movie and Warrior was the natural guy to for that to happen, there was more at stake for WCW with Sting, because the WWF always had that Hogan fallback option, which I think they relied on a bit too much because they never really let Warrior go ahead. I still think he would have failed even if he wasn't in Hogan's shadow. But Sting, there was more at stake here because it was going to be the first true long-term babyface champion that they had had in a while. And yes, Ric Flair was a babyface for much of 1989, but you don't really think of him as kind of that long-term babyface because he was always fighting the battle behind the scenes to try and turn heel again, no matter how much that would help them draw money or what. So there, you know, there, a lot of it was not Sting's fault. I think he probably should have put his foot down on that Black Scorpion Picayune Michigas that they had there, especially after the first clash where you have Sting beat the Black Scorpion and then you have another Black Scorpion. Ha ha ha, you did not really pin the real me. And he should have just put his foot down at that point and say, enough, just please give me a heel challenger of some kind. I mean, it. He really did not have much to work with. And of course, Ole Anderson was booking in 1990 and he was fired right before Starrcade. And that was another parallel with 1988. You had a booker who had his glory days in the past as a booker, and Ole's days, as opposed to Dusty Rhodes. Dusty's best years were much closer to 1988 than Ole's, whose best years were in the late 70s and maybe bled a little bit into the early 80s. But Ole gets fired, so two times in 3 years, they fire the booker right before Starrcade. And, you know, they have Starrcade, and there are some issues with that show that just kind of show WCW's kind of lack of wisdom, I guess might be a good term, For example, why would you have this huge tag team tournament at Starrcade where you're not even really showcasing the guys on, you know, in under your employ? You have all the it is cool to see the great Muda, Masa Saito, and whatever, but do we really need those two guys from Team Canada that nobody remembers who the hell they are, and who knows if they're even from Canada, or the two Russian guys who you never really saw again, or the South African team, which whatever there. So you have seven spots on the card taken up by this tag team tournament, which you don't even, like, why are they, okay, you're doing it so you can put over the Steiners. Well, there are other more efficient ways to put over the Steiners that don't involve taking up seven matches on what was your biggest pay-per-view of the year, seeing that Super Brawl had not been created and Starrcade was definitely considered above the Great American Bash. So there's a little bit more on Starrcade in this show. We got a Gordon Solie update segment, and he kind of runs through the major results at Starrcade 1990. As for this show, the matches on this show, which will include a couple of Starrcade rematches, there's literally no record of where it was taped. And this is one of those WCW things where I like doing the WCW shows, but boy, it can be really difficult tracking down certain information, because if you go on like a Cage Match or any one of those data sites, you can't find, okay, this was taped in Jacksonville, Florida on this date. No idea when this was taped. Like, literally, I have no idea what arena this is. What I can tell you is that this was definitely taped before Starrcade. So they're referring to rematches from Starrcade, which hadn't happened yet when the taping took place. And another interesting thing about this program, which will also feature Sid and Big Van Vader. As I said, Brian Pillman will be on the show as well. We also have advertisements that are part of the video, which is always nice. Get those cool late 1990 commercials of my childhood. Our hosts on TBS are Jim Ross and Missy Hyatt. Missy Hyatt doing color. Well, I'm going to have a few things to say about her work on this show. Perhaps not all complimentary, but I, like a lot of other people, had a childhood crush on Missy Hyatt, so I think I might go a little bit easy as we go along here. So let's jump right in. We got Sid Vicious right off the bat, and oh boy, have I got a few things to say.
For you to justify my love,
that is an appropriate Madonna song to use. Not only time appropriate, but right now I'm going to be trying to justify my love for one Sid Vicious, who will be taking on Johnny Reeves here, who I have no information on. And Sid is in a weird point in his illustrious career. He's still a member of the Four Horsemen, although he seems to be one of those guys that in interviews that Ric Flair conveniently likes to not count as ever being a horseman. I don't know why Sid gets kind of put in that Paul Roma category. Well, I think we all know why, and it has to do with a certain set of scissors, which is, you know, the fight with Arn Anderson is something that obviously I can't defend, but Sid in general is a childhood favorite of mine, and I just have an unabashed love and blind spot for the guy. At this time, 1990, he is still singlet Sid. He is not wearing the trunks. Instead, he has the black singlet on. And I'm very disappointed that he is not announced from his usual hometown of anywhere he damn well pleases, Sid Vicious. But no, they don't even give a hometown. They just say from the Four Horsemen, as if that's some kind of residential development somewhere. And of course, Sid, even as a member of the Horsemen, his role at Starrcade was in yet another tag match on the show, because it needed more tag matches that were outside the seven in that tournament, teaming with Dan Spivey in a reunion of the Skyscrapers. And you got Sid saying, hey, maybe we'll take a run at the tag team titles. He was kind of scatterbrained and all over the place. And of course, Sid, known quite well for being one of the more I guess, scatterbrained and flaky guys ever in the business. Now, as an 11-year-old, this guy was just God to me. And Sid is a perfect example of a guy having in-ring charisma. Obviously, we know he couldn't talk all that well, although Sid was just an amazing guy to imitate, because all you have to do is talk through your teeth, and you can express psychotic anger towards anything. Like last night, I'm flying out of, last night as I tape this, I'm flying out of Atlanta back to Boston, and there's a 2-hour delay that's reported approximately 10 seconds after I get in the security line. That's about a 20-minute line. So all I want to do is express my anger at those runway delays in Boston, and I hope that justice will be served. Just talk through your teeth there. Yes, that all that is actually true, but Sid is a good guy to kind of channel when you're feeling angry, because it'll make you feel better. I mean, he's such a kind of goofy guy, you know, with the "I have half the brain you do." But I don't care. I love him so much. And the powerbomb was part of it, because it was not a move that I was seeing very much, even though Tenryu was doing it in Japan in the 80s. And I believe I saw on Alan underscore Cheapshot on Twitter, who, of course, one of the hosts of Letters from Center Stage, I believe he posted a GIF file of Lou Thesz doing a powerbomb in the 1950s, which is just more evidence that Lou... On South Park, they did an episode where the Simpsons did it first, and talking about how the Simpsons had covered every storyline that anybody could hope to cover. In wrestling, it's almost like Lou Thesz did it already. And you could just take really kind of any move. You figure, well, there's not all the footage out there, but there's, you know, enough footage of Lou Thesz. I can't believe I'm referencing Lou Thesz in a Sid Vicious match here, but I just love Sid so much. Like, in my notes here, all I wrote is, Singlet Sid, From Anywhere He Damn Well Pleases, and then I wrote 2 stars, and I wrote, Gush About Sid. So I hope I've gushed a little bit about Sid, because I was very excited when he came to the WWF in the middle of 1991. Of course, a run that did not quite live up to expectation, although, say this for Sid, he was in 2 WrestleManias, and he was in the main event of both of them. So that's a pretty good batting average he had there. Now, Sid is much, much bigger than this Johnny Reeves character. It's one of those kind of comical size differences we have there. And Missy Hyatt attempts to kind of put it in perspective and gets tied up along the way.
Look at the difference in size here.
There's not that many men that are a size against Sid Vicious, though. But why is Sid all sweaty looking?
Why do I get the feeling this could end up being like the Angelo Mosca Maple Leaf Wrestling show that I covered in episode 9 with the announcer clips here? Nice recovery, though, by Missy at the end, asking why Sid is all sweaty looking. Well, it's probably because he pours a bottle of water over his head, because that's what they do in WWF, and that's where he'll want to go in about 6 months. Sid's doing a lot of yelling and gesturing towards the fans, and there's that in-ring charisma that Sid undoubtedly had. He's kind of picking on somebody at ringside, opposite hard camera and pointing, and Reeves tries to get a shot in on him, which is immediately no-sold, and then he just lays him flat on the floor with a clothesline, and Missy is very surprised that Reeves even bothered to get up. And it's a Sid match. There's not too much to this. He throws Reeves on the top rope in kind of like a hot shot. Not the greatest looking thing in the world there. Kind of beats on him in the corner a bit. And then it looks like kind of a miscommunication there for a second. And you get Sid leaning in to whisper into old Johnny's ear there. And then we get kind of a stinger splash. The Sid-style stinger splash. And we get notice of what Sid is up to. He's a very busy man. He's got the Horsemen, he's got Dan Spivey, and he took time out of his busy schedule the night before on WCW Saturday Night to run Norman, i.e. Norman the Lunatic, into the ring post when poor Norman was out dressed as Santa Claus, handing out presents to kids around ringside. So Sid is truly the Grinch that stole Christmas. And he spits on Reeves at one point, which really upsets JR, who he's just really, really, he said that he has no class.
See, that's disgusting. That has absolutely no class.
And then Sid does a lot of his talking into the camera, which I always enjoyed, with a personal favorite of mine being that WrestleMania 8 match against Hogan that everybody kind of hates, but I actually kind of like that match just for the one moment when he goes over to the corner and says a line that I probably should have made my high school yearbook quote. And he says, Whippleman is up on the apron for some reason too, next to him, and he just glares in and says, "There's an old saying, it goes like this, do unto the man as he will do unto you, but do it first." And then you get the powerbomb on Hogan, and then he kicks out, hulks up, leg drop, Sid kicks out of the leg drop because Papa Shango is late. And of course he gets the win here with the powerbomb, covers poor Reeves with just one hand there, and then talks to the camera. And I'm sorry, no matter what you tell me about Sid not being the best worker, that in-ring charisma and just the memory of him as a child, I don't care. And I don't care that he went to go play softball in the summer, because let me tell you something, if I was a pro wrestler and I made enough money the rest of the year, I would take off for the summer too and go play softball. I haven't gotten to play softball in 10 years now. If Sid's in a league and he's probably a good player, I don't know, I think Sid was probably like me. He was probably only relegated to corner outfield and first base duty, maybe third base in a pinch. I don't know how much range he would have had. I bet that Sid could get a good stretch as a first baseman. I wonder, is there any video of Sid out there playing softball? I would definitely be really interested in seeing that, and maybe if Sid, in terms of his trash talking on the field, he must have had a lot of fun doing it, because otherwise he wouldn't have left wrestling so many times to go play softball, where it would literally become a meme before the internet was ever really a thing.
It's too bad his brain isn't the size of his body.
Actually, Jim, that's probably a good thing, because if his brain were the size of his body, Sid would probably be the Elephant Man.
And there's another thing, Mikhail. The kids these days.
Aye.
Tetris, Schmetris, all the time it's Tetris, Tetris, Tetris they want to play.
Go, go, go!
And it's not just in Russia. All over the world it's Tetris, Tetris. Whatever happened to the unicycle? And the ball.
Oh, damn it! I'm
going to
got it, man!
It's a changing world.
That, of course, is an ad for the Nintendo game Tetris, an earlier example of Russian meddling in American life that would repeat itself some quarter of a century later. Of course, it also meddled with my life as well, because I had a Nintendo system, much like a lot of people of my generation, and Tetris posed a problem for me in that it was the only video game that my father ever liked playing, and in fact, he was monopolizing my Nintendo at times, to the point where, at a certain point, we ended up getting a second Nintendo system anyway, although the one that I had, I think, was about 3 years old, so we got a second one so that my dad could play Tetris and I could play Baseball Stars or whatever I was playing at the time. Next bout features Curtis Hughes, the Big Cat, who would later go on to become Mr. Hughes, and much more famous in that role, facing Jamie McKinnon. And Curtis Hughes is never considered the greatest wrestler in the world, and if you were to tell somebody in the early 90s that this guy would go on to become one of the most well-regarded wrestling trainers in the United States, I don't think anybody would really believe it, but against all odds, somehow that actually happened, with Hughes down in Georgia, he was the head trainer at WWA 4, World Wrestling Alliance 4, And he was the head trainer there until last year when he handed over the reins to one of his underlings, A.R. Fox. And he is credited with training Heath Slater and Apollo Crews, who are now in WWE. There's a much longer list, but those are probably the two most high-profile guys from the list I looked at earlier. Hughes, not wearing his white shirt and kind of the getup that he would become known for later as Mr. Hughes, as he's still the big cat and is very new to the company here. He had a stint in the AWA as a babyface earlier in 1990, and that was not exactly the place to be, to coin a phrase, the AWA in 1990. I think he probably avoided the Team Challenge series there. And Hughes is not wearing that gear. He's wearing trunks and tights, so it's kind of interesting to see him that way. Of course, he would be a short-time guy three different occasions for WWF in the 1990s. He had a run in early 1993 as Mr. Hughes. He made an appearance on the King of the Ring that year in that tournament. And then his two later short-time appearances were around the Royal Rumble time in 1997, serving as the, I guess, butler for Hunter Hearst Helmsley, not the bodyguard, but the butler is how I've, you know, seen and heard it referred. And then in 1999, he was the bodyguard for Chris Jericho for a very, very brief period and mostly forgettable. And he's more famous for his time in World Championship Wrestling. I'm glad that they moved him off of the Big Cat name because it was a little too close to Ernie Ladd, who is the real Big Cat for my liking. And Ernie Ladd had been retired for about 7-8 years by the time of this match. But I don't like giving out a name that quickly. It's kind of like when LaDainian Tomlinson is in the NFL and people are referring to him as LT. And I'm like, we just had Lawrence Taylor less than 10 years ago, and he's one of the most famous players, the greatest pass-rushing linebacker the NFL had ever seen, and we're just going to hand out his nickname to somebody else. You could have found something other than Big Cat. So I think that it was nice that they moved off that. Again, kind of like Sid, he's a big man, not too dynamic in the ring. Like I said, it's really strange that he went on to become such an accomplished trainer. Suplex by Hughes, the Big Cat, and he just pulls the guy up in a real heel move rather than pinning him. He does get a nice, what I like to call the Ted DiBiase power slam off the Irish whip, where he catches the guy for the quick power slam. And then, oddly enough, he gets the win with the torture rack. And I say oddly because very strange that he would have that as a finisher when Lex Luger is right there. He's the United States champion after his match at Starrcade with Stan Hansen. And it's just really odd that somebody else would get to use the same finisher as one of the highest profile guys that your promotion has. But I'll tell you, that's WCW for you right there in a nutshell.
Introducing the new wrestling hotline. Tony Schiavone. Matt Watts with Steve Beverly. Missy Hyatt. Straight Up with Sting. No. Lex Luger. The Jim Ross Report. Paul E. Dangerously. 1-900-909-9900. The wrestling hotline. Your main line to the stars. $2 first minute, 45 cents each additional minute. Kids 18 and under obtain your parents' permission before calling. 1-900-909-9900.
Dial it.
Yes, the WCW hotline would have different days of the week for different people. Missy Hyatt's day was Wednesday, and she had talked about that in the earlier match. Said, "I talk about the wrestlers, and I stooge on them." And JR is like, what a shock that is. Of course, Missy wrote a book in around 2001 time frame that I took a peek at in researching for this show. I don't know how much there really was in there for me to go on. I wish that book was available in a Kindle format, but a lot of the wrestling books from that time period that were not, say, Mick Foley's book on the bestseller list, can't really get them in a Kindle format. I did read some salacious material there about her and Eric Watts that was in the book, and I'll leave that to your imagination. So our ad wrap-up there, in addition to the WCW Hotline, you can subscribe to the WCW Wrestling Wrap-Up Magazine, 12 issues for $24.95. Boy, you're going to have to hold me back for that one. On TNT this Thursday, The Awful Truth, starring Cary Grant. And this, of course, a time when TNT, instead of, you know, the We Know drama, they would show really old movies, as Turner Classic Movies had not yet been created, so a lot of the old stuff in the Turner catalog would be thrown onto TNT in prime time during the week. Of course, we got the Wrestling Hotline, and then we have an ad for Subway Restaurants, and that was around the time Subway started appearing in my area. And of course, Subway, now alongside McDonald's, is just having the most locations of anybody. And also one of my odder brushes with greatness, of course, Subway founded by Fred DeLuca, who is a businessman, I believe, from the Atlanta, Georgia area. And when I went to my friend Craig's wedding in 2005 down in Atlanta, which was actually my previous trip to Atlanta, Georgia before this past weekend, when I went to the wedding, I sat down, and then who should sit down with me to my immediate right but Fred DeLuca himself. We didn't say anything to each other. It's just that a multi-billionaire sitting down next to me has always amused me in retrospect. So we have Gordon Solie, and he's giving us a Starrcade 1990 wrap-up here. And just kept going over the things that happened during the show. We see the finish of the Steiner Brothers versus Great Muta and Masa Saito, the finals of the Pat O'Connor Memorial Tag Team Tournament, which of course was won by the Steiners. And that was a really good match. However, it could have been an even better match if, say, you only put the finals on the actual pay-per-view and you did the other matches earlier. Or how about this? How about just pretend that Team Canada lost to whoever they lost to in the first round, I believe the Soviets, and just not televise it anywhere? Just make it like the IC tournament in Rio de Janeiro. Like, we really wouldn't care, okay? You didn't need that many tag matches on one show, although it was interesting from the perspective of seeing Norman Smiley in 1990 and seeing Chris Adams really putting out his best effort to try and get a job. But with being Chris Adams and all, things would come up as they always seem to. Conan, under a mask, some 6 years before he would become a regular in WCW and a United States champion at a point in 1996. Yeah. You know, I guess it was okay to have all those countries there, but you could have nailed it down to just the semifinals and the finals. I'm willing to compromise there, but don't make all these, both those teams work two matches before their big final match. We see the finish of Lex Luger versus Stan Hansen in a bull rope match, and it's very confusing as to what's going on, as you have a dusty finish of sorts, but with a twist in that you have two referees in there, and eventually they just agree to give the match to Luger, which was bizarre and probably the only way you could just get the belt off Hansen at that point, who was probably not too thrilled about jobbing in terms of a pinfall, so they work out this finish. And it's kind of funny that they're working a kind of quasi Dusty finish, since Dusty was certainly on his way back to WCW, as he had already given his notice to the WWF, and he was putting over Virgil in 45 seconds at various house shows around the loop. So Luger regains the United States title after a brief reign by Stan Hansen. We see the end of the Black Scorpion versus Sting, and just the botched unmasking where there were just too many guys in the ring, and you couldn't really see what was going on, and you never actually see Ric Flair's face, although he was hiding his shame there. And Jim Ross on commentary there is kind of the most memorable part of that for me, because he's almost, he almost has a tone in his voice of like, guys, you got to get the mask off. He's like, we got 30 seconds left. Who is it? It's got blonde hair. It's Ric Flair. And you can't even really even see that it's Ric Flair because his hair is all different. And it's one of those things that Ric Flair not happy about having to redo his entire hairstyle because it never came back quite to the way that it was. It's rather funny. Gordon gives kind of an editorial here, and Gordon kind of goes into like full dad / grandpa mode. He's like, I've never been more disappointed in Ric Flair, almost treating like as if Ric Flair was his son who got suspended from school or something like that. He's just really, really ashamed of what the Nature Boy has resorted to.
A personal comment, if you will. I've known and respected Ric Flair as a world champion for a number of years. There have none been greater. However, what he has perpetrated along with the Horseman on Sting, who is a good, a decent, and an honorable man, is most reprehensible. Very frankly, my opinion of Ric Flair has gone down a lot. You be the judge as to how you feel.
Wow, that's like Walter Cronkite coming out against the Vietnam War in 1968. Ric Flair losing the support there of Gordon Solie. Although it's kind of funny because for all the Ric Flair turns on Sting through the years, you could really just kind of cut and paste that in every single instance, although he didn't always have the Horseman with him. But yeah, cut that in into the Halloween Havoc 95 turn on Sting, which is probably the best one out of all of them because of how Sting knew it was coming and said, don't try and swerve me or so help me God. And then Flair just swerves him anyway. It's just amazing. We go back to JR and Missy Hyatt, and Missy kind of she shows her Christmas list, which may or may not have been printed on a dot matrix printer, and she lets go of it, and it's like a really long list, like the paper just comically sort of falls to the floor, and Jim Ross kind of looking at it like it's very, very childlike and is wondering if she asked for a Barbie doll or a Ken doll. Of course, in 1991, Missy would end up getting a Ken doll along with the rest of WCW when Eric Bischoff would come in, the human Ken doll, as the C-level announcer. Of course, Missy, one of the things that I picked up from the parts of her book that I was able to see online, not a fan of Eric Bischoff and his work. They don't see eye to eye. We get another ad break here, and the Tetris ad airs again, but I'm blown away by the ad for the Star Wars trilogy. The original, you have New Hope, Empire Strikes Back, and Return of the Jedi, available on VHS, which you can purchase separately or together. I think it's only a small discount for buying them together, so you might as well just buy all three. And I want those because Han shot first in those videos. George Lucas had not yet meddled with any of that in 1990.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which of course includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero here, and I want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com, and we now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with clotheslines and headlines, main event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows. And we leave wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse. the Our Vantage Point podcast, which features a potpourri-style look at wrestling history, and Survey Says, a fun look back at the good, bad, and ugly of WCW. And on our very popular Place of Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler podcast, Our Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversations, Geek and Sassy, and the Imaginary Stories. You can find all these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All these shows plus others available at PlayStation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlayStation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh eBooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, thehistoryofwrestling.com, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
So yes, do check out the other shows on the network. A few that I want to mention specifically, there is an ROH history podcast that is red hot. I believe there are about 6 episodes out so far in the early years of ROH called Throw the Years, which is spelled STHROH, the years. So I like the name of that show very much. Of course, as always, This Week in Wrestling. And one episode in particular that I want to point out on Space City, an NWA On Demand podcast, which is Pete and Johnny from the Titans of Wrestling. There was an episode after Pete had gone to the Wrestling Hall of Fame induction weekend down in Wichita Falls, Texas. And he's telling stories of being at the Hall of Fame and running into a lot of the greats who were there for the ceremony that weekend, including Mick Foley, who was being inducted, and the lot of great stories. And the best one by far, and this is why you should tune in, is the Mick Foley, Gary Young story, about 2/3 of the way through the podcast, I think it was. But give that a listen, if you will. And of course, there's Letters from Center Stage. But right now, kind of to call back to the mothership show of this feed, the Where the Big Boys Play podcast, we have a Parv favorite, the Zed Man, Tom Zink, taking on Bobby Eaton in the first of our Starrcade rematches. Eaton was the winner at Starrcade, so let's see if we get 50-50 booking here. Eaton still has his Midnight Express music. Stan Lane and Jim Cornette had left right at Halloween Havoc 1990, and Eaton is still being introduced as being from the dark side, where he would eventually, shortly after this, sell his place in the dark side. I don't know what kind of capital gains he realized on the sale of his home there. He would move back to Alabama. So that was the Bobby Eaton that we would know and love in the early 90s. And Missy Hyatt here, she had a thing for the Z-Man, or the Z-Man, Tom Zink, calling him a hot babe. And Missy is just entirely smitten. And I don't know if those two ever consummated her feelings or whatever. I'm sure there are a lot of Tom Zink shoot interviews, as he's kind of a legend in that area of wrestling. And of course, Missy's book, but I never saw anything about her and Tom Zink, who I don't... Tom Zink is a weird case in that he looks like a guy who should be really, really good in the ring, but I'm always left kind of wanting. And Bobby Eaton, of course, one of the greatest tag wrestlers of all time, and was actually referred to as such, the greatest tag worker of all time, by Pauly Dangerously on the Starrcade 1990 telecast. And there's no question about that, but his work as a single can be a little bit spotty at times, and that was definitely the case here. I do recall earlier, there was a mistake, I think, on the Starrcade 90 cast or something to that, where they talked about it being a first Eaton singles match on a pay-per-view. But nope, that is not the case, as Eaton had a extremely boring match with Nikita Koloff to kick off Bunkhouse Stampede 1988, just kind of giving you a vision of what was to come on that particular show. And Eaton, as a singles, where he would, his high point would be as a babyface working a 2 out of 3 falls with Ric Flair at the Clash in June of 91, a match that I really, really loved as a kid. But as an adult, I look at it now and see that it was only 14 minutes, and they needed another 5 to 10 minutes at least in order to make that work. Of course, that was the Clash where they decided to do 15 angles in a 2+ hour show, and just kind of, it was a little too Russo-rific in a pre-Russo world. So in our match here, we get Z-Man working the arm early, and Bobby Eaton is very, very vocal towards the fans. He's kind of gesturing towards somebody as when he came to the ring. He's really concerned about somebody at ringside. And Bobby Eaton, not known for being much of a talker, but on this day, he was, I guess, kind of feeling it. He was called a whiner and a complainer here on the broadcast. And Missy kind of goes into a thing. Her feud with Pauly Dangerously was just ongoing. She was very happy that the Danger Zone, the normal Paul E. interview segment, was canceled this week in favor of the Starcade report. And JR just calls Missy and Paul E. kind of the whiner cousins, Wayne and Wendy Whiner.
You can't stand a whiner and a complainer, huh?
Now, he gets on my nerves.
You know, when you two guys are together, you could almost be the whiner cousins. Wayne and Wendy Whiner. Missy and Paul.
I don't whine. I don't complain. I don't give people headaches.
Oh, Missy, I love you, but you're kind of ill-suited for this role with the voice that you have. It really doesn't work.
I need some Tylenol.
Thanks, Angelo. Could you pick up a few for me while you're opening the bottle there? Get a wrist lock by Eaton, and the Z-Man gets out of it, and then there's a slam. This match is just going really, really slow. Like I said, Zenk is almost presented as kind of like a big cruiserweight, or at least that's what he looks like, and it's just, there's just nothing there for some reason. I really don't get it. I mean, people saw something in him, and I'm not entirely sure what that was. We get a test of strength, so both guys are really focused in here, and Missy once again is pining for Tom Zenk.
Well, Z-Man can break my concentration anytime.
Big Van Vader on the program.
I love how Ross just kind of no-sells what Missy is saying. I think he's just kind of given up here in terms of trying to relate to just Missy being like a complete horn dog for Tom Zenk. You get Eaton with a back elbow, a slam and an elbow drop, but that only gets 2. Then he just kind of does that thing where he tweaks his nose, like kind of grabs him from behind and grabs his face. And then we're into a chin lock, and this match is not really doing much for me, but during a short break in the action there, they take the time to talk about the upcoming Clash of the Champions scheduled for Wednesday, January 30th of 1991, which was kind of an interesting show in that the original concept was to hold the Clash in CNN Center, which of course did not come to fruition, as they moved the show out of there because you had the Gulf War going on. And of course, those of us who remember that time and that first Gulf War happening with all the military activity in Kuwait, that was kind of CNN's coming out party as a 24-hour news network. Yes, they'd been around for over a decade at that point and were on all the cable systems, but just kind of seeing the footage of the airstrikes and all that sort of stuff, and it made a star out of Wolf Blitzer. Wolf Blitzer definitely got over from the Gulf War, I would say. So, and that was the one that was Ric Flair versus Scott Steiner in the main event, which that would become a very interesting thing about 10 years later. I think there was a Scott Steiner shoot on Ric Flair on one of the very late WCW shows. But as I've mentioned before, anything after the summer of 1999 for WCW, I just get a headache, and I'm going to need Mosca to get me more Tylenol if I'm going to talk about that. The two crack heads, and they fall outside the ring, And Eaton is thrown to the post after the Z-Man blocks Beautiful Bobby's attempt to send him into the post. And the Z-Man just beats the count in to the ring and wins by a count out. So yes, we do have some 50-50 booking here. And my God, this match completely sucked. I'm not usually too negative about matches on this show. I mean, most of these are squash matches that I'm covering. So I do a show like WCW Main Event. You have two name guys in a match, and you hope, okay, well, this will be something. But this was just completely awful. I'm not going to do the negative 5 stars, but this was really not worth my time. There was more going on commentary, and we had Missy Hyatt as half of that, so I don't know how much there. They slug it out after the match in the ring as if we needed more of Eaton versus Zink. And nothing really happens there. It just kind of just cuts to an ad for the WCW hotline again. And Zink would win the TV title off of Arn Anderson. But it was one of those things where, you know, there was a taping and then when it aired. And I think it may have been taped before this. But then again, I don't know when this actual show was taped. So who knows? And then Beautiful Bobby would get a TV title reign that was fairly brief in May and into early June. And he would drop it to a newcomer to the scene. Some guy by the name of Steve Austin. Stunning Steve Austin, I think that was his name. He had a very busty valet. So, yeah. We got ads here for Rising Sun. So no, not the name of Shinsuke Nakamura's theme, but a movie that is coming soon to your local Blockbuster Video. Remember Blockbuster Video? And we get Look Who's Talking To, that great John Travolta vehicle. And then we have Sega Genesis Joe Montana Football. And I have to say that it is not Joe Montana Sports Talk Football, which is the one that really put that kind of brought sports gaming to the next level, having a play-by-play guy, and not only a play-by-play guy, an actual guy who did games in the Bay Area, a guy by the name of Lon Simmons. Not to be confused with Ron Simmons. We're talking about Lon Simmons. That's the guy whose voice you hear on Joe Montana 2 Sports Talk Football, who says stuff like, "There's no score," and "It's beginning to snow." I really like that game. I don't care how bad the play-by-play actually was, but that was a huge thing in the video games at the time, to have play-by-play. Of course, kids like me were recording themselves calling play-by-play for Baseball Stars. I wonder if any of those tapes still exist. Of course, who the heck would want to listen to me announcing my NBA Jam games or whatever?
The Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network. Subscribe on iTunes or on Android with your favorite podcast app. Established in 2013, the Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network is committed to providing unique takes on the rich and diverse medium of professional wrestling, focusing on its history and global impact, but also exploring the vibrant contemporary scene. The roll call includes Space City, an NWA On Demand podcast, This Week in Wrestling, Stacey and Elliott's Bogus Journey, the Super Apuitas podcast, the Military Industrial Suplex, Strong Style History, Puro Puri, and Psychology is Dead. Also, from the archives, the full catalog of great shows that provided a fresh look at classic wrestling, including Where the Big Boys Play, Titans of Wrestling, Tag Teams Back Again, Letters from Kayfabe, Wrestling Culture, Pro Wrestling Super Show, Goodwill Wrestling, and many, many others. Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network. Only the best.
It's time. It's time. It's Big Van Vader time. Very early appearance for the big man from Colorado. And he's in a handicap match here. So one of those old Andre the Giant style specials here against Paul Lee and Barry DeVille. And Big Van Vader is wearing a full mask at this point with the full smoking helmet thing on the way to the ring. And I recall an early Steve Austin show where he had Vader, Leon White, on the program and asking him about that particular apparatus. I really don't even know what to call it. And he said that it was a real pain in the butt to travel with, which I can imagine. I mean, some guys have trouble carrying their championship belts, and he's got like this whole shoulder pad and helmet dealie that is supposed to blow smoke and all that. I can't even imagine trying to get that through like airport security in today's world. This, like him like having the conversation with the TSA agent or whatever. Vader at this time, he's wearing a full mask, so it's not like the string mask that he would become more famous for later. He too is introduced as being from the dark side. So I'm wondering if he moved into Eaton's neighborhood or whatever. It's more fitting that a guy named Vader lives on the dark side rather than Bobby Eaton, who looks like a good old boy, but just happened to live on the dark side with his pals from the Midnight Express. And Vader was kind of in and out very early in his WCW stay. They did vignettes for him starting in the summer, but he had some Japan commitments as well. He was, as I said, he was sort of in and out, not truly full-time until you get later into 1991. And then in 1992 is when he would really take hold and then win the WCW world title at the Great American Bash against Sting in a really kind of interesting match, in that Sting, I wouldn't say he got squashed, but it was a decisive win for a heel in a world title match on a pay-per-view. And of course, Vader's WCW, he's another example, like Rick Rude and Lex Luger, of WCW utilizing a guy much better than the WWF did. And this is, of course, as I mentioned, the Gulf War earlier, they're talking about Operation Desert Shield, which was the kind of before the war. They set up Operation Desert Shield, where they put all the troops in the area to kind of prepare. And this was like 4.5 months that they did this, from early August until the offensive was launched in the middle of January. And at that time, January 17th of 91, somewhere in that ballpark, is when it would become Operation Desert Storm. And Missy, it's a really weird sentiment. They're talking about the troops that are over there now during the holiday season. It's just really weird what Missy has to say.
And we wish y'all were at home during the Christmas time, and it's a shame that they have to be over there.
I don't know why, that just kind of struck my ear a little bit weird. This is right after JR had said that, hey, Missy, don't you wish that Paul Lee was actually Paul E? And Missy says something to the effect of, yeah, and that'd be great, because then Big Van Vader can then sit on his head and squish him. I'm like, that's kind of graphic there. Missy is also thankful for her Christmas bonus that she was given, and JR doesn't really seem to know anything about Christmas bonuses handed out here. There is an actual match here. You get Vader, and he's a true boss in there, and just really dominant. He press slams DeVille, not a Cadillac DeVille, but Barry DeVille, and then he clotheslines both of them. We get an avalanche and a power slam on Lee, so we don't get Missy's wish fulfilled there, although he does land the big splash on Lee and puts him down. But then DeVille comes back in, and we get another power-ish kind of slam on him, and he lands a big splash on both guys at the same time, which was a pretty neat trick, and then they both get pinned at the same time. So really just a quick squash for Vader to establish him as a monster, but it took a little bit because he wasn't always there. But this is a guy who, when he would come in, he was immediately a monster no matter where he went. Of course, WWF would screw it up, although some of it had to do with reasons of Vader. You know, he wasn't in the best shape at that point, and maybe not at the best place in his life. But we're talking about a guy who debuted in New Japan Pro Wrestling by squashing Antonio Inoki in 4 minutes, which is one of the crazier things that ever happened. But that is how you build a guy and just make him in an instant. And that made Vader a really huge deal in Japan. 1990, so we have an ad for the Sega Genesis game, Michael Jackson's Moonwalker, which regrettably is one that I never got to play because around 1990 or so, I just started blowing off all non-sports games. So I once I got past the Nintendo, once you go from 8-bit to 16-bit, and of course we're right in the middle of the Genesis versus Super Nintendo, and I was definitely Team Genesis there. I never really dug the Nintendo controller. I felt that Genesis had enough with the three buttons, and I thought that they just had better sports games. And it would pose a problem for me in high school when, oh, you want to come over and play Madden? Oh, you have a Super Nintendo. I only play Genesis. So, like, it would have to be, like, these weird negotiations for video games with my friends. I don't know. Perhaps I'm just the weird one there. Although I am still mad about a particular incident playing Madden football over at a friend's house where I had scored the winning touchdown with no time left on the clock, and it actually tied the game, so I still had to kick the extra point. And what my friend kept doing was he kept going offside on the extra point so that the game would never end, because that's actually known as what is called a palpably unfair act in the game of American football, and officials have a pretty wide latitude in terms of penalties, particularly at the high school level, that include forfeiture of the game. So I'm going to declare right now that I won this 22-year-old or 23-year-old game of Madden against a guy who is probably not listening to this show. And speaking of rivalries that go back a long time, we got Missy Hyatt here, and we got a match coming up between Michael Wall Street and Terry Taylor in yet another rematch from Starrcade. And of course, Missy Hyatt and Alexandra York were really the two women of WCW at this time. Alexandra York is, of course, would go on to become Terry Runnels. And at this time, she was very new. She was kind of pulled, I guess, out of the makeup department and given a role as the manager of the York Foundation in an early case of Moneyball, using computer-generated statistical analysis to help her men win matches and also make weird predictions like how long it will take them to win the matches. So there's a natural rivalry there between Missy and Alexandra York, so I found her comments kind of interesting.
What is your assessment of Miss York?
Well, she's smart, like me. She's good-looking, like me. But there's only one thing she's got that I don't have, and that's that good right slap on Terry Taylor. And you know, I think she's going to teach me how to do that to you, Jim.
This is not Barstool Sports or anything, so I don't want to get into like a whole babe sort of thing, but let me just go back to kind of how I felt at the time as a young lad looking at these two lovely women. Of course, Missy Hyatt, you know, oh, she was the blonde and all that, but Alexandra York, I kind of looked at as, quote, an attainable hot. I think that was a concept that was brought up on Friends or something. I don't know, but maybe that speaks more to my own self-esteem or lack thereof. Speaking of people who have low self-esteem because of things that had happened in their life, Terry Taylor. And we get footage of him cutting an angry promo in the ring. He's with Paul E. Dangerously. I guess this was an earlier edition of the Danger Zone. And Ms. York comes to the ring with Michael Wall Street. This is all pre their Starrcade match. And York just gets in the ring and says that her computer says that her man will beat Terry Taylor in 8 minutes and 32 seconds. And Taylor says that York must have some kind of kink in the system, and he gets slapped for his trouble, as Missy alluded to there. And there actually was an issue with the computer there, as it did not take Michael Wall Street 8 minutes and 32 seconds to beat Taylor, because he finished him off in 6:52 at Starrcade 1990. So this sets up the rematch between Taylor and Wall Street. And the York Foundation music is something that I really loved, and I could not put my finger on it at the time, but as we all know now, and it would be dubbed over on the network, I don't know if there are any York Foundation shows. I guess the Great American Bash 91, you have Terrence Taylor, who would go on to join the York Foundation for reasons I'll get into in a second. The York Foundation music was a complete ripoff of the theme from the TV show Dallas. Now, I do realize that Dallas is a show that aired nearly 40 years ago now. We got the York Foundation music playing underneath right now as kind of a basis of comparison. So what I'll do is I'll now play the Dallas music, and you can kind of see the similarities there. And I know, what a shocker that WCW would rip off existing music and just repurpose it. But hey, you know, when I was 11, 12 years old, I didn't notice the difference. I just thought it was this cool song that I couldn't put my finger on. And yep, sure enough, it's the theme from the TV show Dallas. Now, all in all, I do think that the York Foundation gimmick was a good try, at the very least, to have kind of the computer futuristic whatever gimmick. It was a good effort. I'm not sure that maybe they had the right people involved. Perhaps if it was Ricky Morton from a few years earlier, although that whole Rock and Roll Express breakup was just completely, like, it was not exactly the best WCW angle there. And of course you had Thomas Rich, whose best years are probably behind him as well. And then you had Terry Taylor join the group as Terrence Taylor. And that is only because Michael Wall Street jumped ship on February 2nd. He up and quit and went to the WWF, where, of course, he would become IRS, as has been I've aired a couple of IRS vignettes on previous shows from both 1991 and 1994. So he's been a key part of the Greetings from Allentown canon as we've gone along. They were promoting this article that supposedly existed with Michael Wall Street in USA Today, and I spent way too much time searching online trying to find out if this actually exists. And if I could have found it, I would have quoted the article chapter and verse. You can be assured of that. But it doesn't seem to exist online, probably because nobody would have thought to save it if it did exist. I think it probably doesn't. So he leaves WCW just in the middle of the night, so they just have to kind of shift his rival here into the same role, where, you know, Taylor becomes the computerized man of the 1990s. And just another one of those Terry Taylor things that didn't seem to work. And probably the highlight of his run there was the infamous scaffold match to kick off the 1991 Great American Bash. And now Wall Street ends up outside the ring, and they are consulting the computer printout, which I'm wondering, is this a spot list of some kind? I'm sure that if Macho Man Randy Savage, who was, you know, noted for being very meticulous in planning out his matches, I'm sure he would have appreciated having a piece of paper there to kind of guide him along through these matches. And of course, well, there is no internet at that time, so I guess it's really just kind of a word processor that computer is. It's just kind of gathering that sort of data. And I would argue that, oh no, it's not that they know exactly what the opponent is going to do. It's not Minority Report. It's really just kind of a scouting report that they're bringing to the ring. And they have it in printouts and whatever. And they show Alexandra York typing, which I don't know, maybe she's just making observations of some kind. I don't think Alexandra York is exactly Gerald Briscoe or anything like that. And Missy Hyatt is very annoying here. I know, what a shocker. And she's very upset that she can't win Sexiest Wrestler. Now, I want to point out that, Missy, you aren't a wrestler, but all Missy is doing is kind of reinforcing the worst stereotypes of her. She's not exactly, she's kind of setting back the whole idea of using a woman as a color commentator like 25 years. Let's just say, Renee Young, she ain't. Because I really enjoyed Renee Young when she was doing color on NXT in 2014 before they moved her, I guess, exclusively into studio roles. Fans are chanting Walmart, Walmart at Michael Wall Street, which is kind of funny because Walmart would become one of the biggest conglomerates there ever was. Because in 1990, I'm not sure how big they were. Obviously, the Walton family was extremely wealthy from the Walmart family of stores, but they really weren't so much in the Northeast by that time. I know there was a giant Walmart built in Danvers, Massachusetts around 1998. I only know that because it was behind the PetSmart I was I was working in. Now, Missy Hyatt is very confused about just how rich the Walton family is in terms of the Walmart chain.
Walmart instead
and they,
of you know, Wall Street.
I was reading, and they had the top, 10 heirs, richest heirs, and most of them were from that Walmart chain.
European farm. Yeah, maybe you can meet one and marry one. That would be
Nah, they were all old.
Poor Jim Ross, he really just wants to get rid of Missy and get Tony Schiavone or Paul E. back on commentary here, because he's just kind of had enough with the Missy Hyatt comments, and he's going to start no-selling it. So we get Wall Street with a side headlock on the mat, and you know what that means. He is doing the foot on the rope to, I don't know, I guess gain leverage or something, but at least it's a change from Mike Rotundo's usual abdominal stretch while grabbing the top rope. Although I actually really enjoy what he does that, even though it's he would overdo it so much going forward, but always a favorite of mine. Taylor tries to get in some offense, but Wall Street cuts him off with a clothesline and a leg drop, which gets two. Then Wall Street goes for a splash, and you can tell it's going to miss because he's perfectly lined up with Terry Taylor's knees, and you can see it before Taylor even lifts his knees. So, and then we get a back elbow from Terry Taylor and a clothesline, and Wall Street ends up outside, and Alexandra York is there, and Terry Taylor swipes the printout and rips it up. I'm not exactly sure what he was hoping to accomplish there. Like, oh no, I'm just going to have to go to the back and print it out again. Although, it was during the dot matrix printer era, so that probably would take about 5 or 6 minutes to actually print that stuff out. Now, Michael Wall Street, he gets all mad here, and they kind of have a little brouhaha, and this is just a nothing match. Like I said, it's a rematch of something that hadn't happened yet by the time you tape this show, and Taylor misses on something, and we get a backdrop by Michael Wall Street over the top rope, and it's a question of, did he go over via his own momentum or whatever? And they DQ Michael Wall Street for, quote-unquote, throwing Terry Taylor over the top rope. I always hated that rule. I understand why it was there. It was to give them another finish, but when did that finish ever really serve to accomplish anything? It was only ever really used, I guess, in situations like this where you just wanted no finish, or in big title matches where you wanted to screw the fans out of the desired ending, which would be a staple of the AWA and the NWA, particularly in the Super Sunday in the AWA with Hulk Hogan versus Nick Bockwinkel.
In peace, I betrayed my wife. In war, I betrayed myself. With trust, I killed men. With vengeance, and I ordered men to be killed. Right or wrong, one man controls this empire.
It was not what I wanted!
On Christmas Day, the Godfather pulls you back into his power. The Godfather, Part 3, rated R.
I'm not so sure that Godfather 3 is a, quote, bad movie. It kind of languishes in the shadow of the first two Godfathers, which, of course, had been released 15 years previous to this. But the movie, released on Christmas Day in 1990 in the United States, kind of languished in the shadow of the buzzsaw that was Home Alone, the original, which was number one from the time of its release in early to mid-November 1990 all the way to early February of 1991. That movie was number one for about 12 or 13 weeks. And you'd think that being of the age that I am, that I would have a soft spot for Home Alone, and I just never really felt that movie at all. I have a couple of issues with the film. I feel that the parenting of Catherine O'Hara there and how forgetful she is, it's like one of the all-time examples of white privilege there ever was. I mean, oh, you fly off to a foreign country and you leave your kid alone and somehow you don't get into any trouble. I mean, think of if that happened today. I mean, if they weren't rich, can you imagine what kind of trouble they would get in with whatever Department of Social Services was there, I guess in Illinois? And also, the Wet Bandits, Joe Pesci and Daniel Stern, I really feel like they could have worked a safer style instead of this big bumping over the top thing. I mean, it's like they're trying to do like a Mick Foley gimmick before Mick Foley really ever became a thing. So whatever with Home Alone, we're on to our final match here, and we have Rob Morgan taking on Flying Brian Pillman. And Rob Morgan has a pretty sweet looking mustache, so I do have to point that out. Now, Brian Pillman is one of the all-time great baby faces, and I know that Dylan Hales at Dylan Waco on Twitter, please contact him to pick up your Scenic City Invitational tickets, one of the biggest events in all of independent wrestling in the United States, coming this August in Chattanooga. Just wanted to get that plug in there for him. And he's made the case many times that Brian Pillman is one of the all-time great baby faces from this era. And I tend to agree, and it's yet another example of a missed opportunity for WCW, particularly in 1990. And I kind of link him a little bit with Tom Zenk in that they were teamed together during 1990 because Ole Anderson, oh God, God forbid that he push Brian Pillman and actually see the potential in him. So he teams him with Tom Zenk as kind of the two pretty boys, and it was really a waste of Brian Pillman, who had had this great match with Ric Flair early in the year. And there was just so much more there. It's Brian Pillman kind of represents, he's everything that Tom Zenk kind of looks like but actually isn't. And it's just, you know, there's so much with Brian Pillman that could have been but just never was. And I'm not talking about the end of his career. I'm talking about in his WCW time where, you know, the push got stunted or some kind of politics got in the way or Bill Watts wanted to make him a job. I mean, it's just time and time again, and it just makes me so sad because Pillman was certainly one of my favorites at the time, as I was a mild Cincinnati Bengals fan at the time. Sure, I am a Patriots fan, but at the time, the Patriots were always kind of teetering and on the verge of moving somewhere else. So I kind of had the Bengals as a second team, as a Boomer Esiason fan. Of course, Jim Ross would point out that Pillman was a member of the Cincinnati Bengals special teams in 1984, it was. And we got Missy Hyatt. Oh, God, Missy. Missy tries to make a funny here and tries to rework an old joke to make fun of Pillman's football career.
He played a guard tackle in.
Okay, yeah.
You know what that is?
Uh-huh.
He sat on the end of the bench, he guarded the water bucket, and he tackled anybody that came close to it that wasn't supposed to.
That's great. First time I heard that, I kicked the slats out of my cradle.
JR just totally wants to go home now. He's just simply had enough here. I get a chop exchange, which a staple of a Brian Pillman match because he can really lay him in, and then a spin kick. I do have to note about Pillman's hair. His mullet looks way better than the other mullets of the era. I don't know if it's just him not being a kind of jobber because, you know, a lot of those guys would have these kind of weird-looking mullets. But I don't know. Something about Pillman's hair, I think, looks okay. I don't think I could pull it off, but I don't think it looks bad. And Morgan gets in some offense here, so that's actually a good thing because that means Brian Pillman can fire up. And that was a huge strength of his in all of his matches, although we get a botch off the ropes. So this is a second time in 2 weeks where we have a botch coming off the ropes after the Davey Boy Smith crossbody into the back of the Menace or whoever that was on the last show. You get huge Ronnie Garvin-style chops by Brian Pillman. Of course, they always say that he learned at the feet of Ric Flair on the chops. I don't know, because I always hear David Bix's fans say that Stan Lane was the only wrestler trained by Ric Flair, which I'm assuming there must have been an interview somewhere where Stan Lane just constantly mentioned the fact that he was the only wrestler trained by Ric Flair. That's what I'm assuming anyway. We get a senton by Brian Pillman, and Jim Ross doesn't really know what to call it, because that's not something you would often see in 1990. And he picks up the win with the flying body press, and Pillman, he would find his way, I think, a little bit more when they would have the cruiserweight division. The problem with the cruiserweight division that they would have, although I guess they were calling it the light heavyweight at that time, is when you're in kind of that weight group, you kind of get pigeonholed there. So that means he could never be a contender, say, for the heavyweight title. He would only be put against the likes of Liger and the rest of them, I guess Morton, and in that whole tournament, Brad Armstrong. And then he would turn heel in 1992, and Pillman was a pretty good heel, obviously, as well. I do prefer him, I guess, as a babyface, although I did say that his loose cannon gimmick is one of my favorite of all time. So really, just kind of, it's only fitting that, you know, I'm an unabashed fan of Brian Pillman, so it's kind of bookends here with the Sid thing earlier. It's just two of my favorites all time here on WCW Main Event, December 1990. Wrapping up the show, and Missy Hyatt helpfully lets us know that there is still time for the viewing audience to overnight any Christmas presents they may have for her. But we get Paulie Dangerously crashing onto the set to continue that feud between Missy and Paulie. Of course, they would have the arm wrestling contest at a Clash coming up, and would have the kind of humorous ending where Missy would reveal a bit of cleavage and Paulie would be gawking at it and then would lose the arm wrestling match. So he crashes in, and Jim Ross is a little bit offended by this and says, "What do you think? You could just come to work whenever you want?" And I would have loved it. Paulie, of course, now the advocate for Brock Lesnar, you know, Brock Lesnar, the guy who literally comes to work whenever he wants. I mean, think about it. He's there once every 3 or 4 months and actually is the Universal Champion, even though they strip people of the title for being injured and being out the same amount of time that Brock Lesnar is just gone on hiatus. But in any event, so you get Paul E. there, and he's there to save us, but it's way too late because the show is over, and that's all she wrote.
Next week, Jim, if you don't mind, and quite frankly, even if you do, I'll be back on the Main Event with the Danger Zone.
I don't think so, Paul.
What do you mean you don't think so?
I think you need to learn a lesson. You just can't arbitrarily take your program on, come to work when you want.
You want to bet?
Yeah, I'll bet you.
You want to? How much you want to bet? Who's going to do it?
Well, there'll be no Danger Zone next week, fans.
Will.
Tune in and
you're
find out.
Me?
Yeah, right. You're not
going to
be on. Forget it. Forget it.
Yeah, Paul Heyman, I think, definitely won that bet with Jim Ross when it comes to just showing up and being able to work whenever you want. Because Heyman is kind of on that schedule, too, because he's so attached to Brock Lesnar in the modern product. Now, for those of you who are listening on the Pro Wrestling Only feed and are relatively new to the Greetings from Allentown podcast, I do have a segment called YouTube Comment Theater that I haven't been able to do the last couple of weeks because either the video is not on YouTube any longer or for lack of comments. So when you watch a wrestling video, especially full episodes, don't be afraid to weigh in with comments. And because there's actually, I'm putting the video on the Greetings from Allentown playlist, and the only comment there is actually from me, regretting the fact that the ring announcer did not say that Sid is from anywhere he damn well pleases. So this is the part of the show where I would tell you what episode I am doing next. And I'm kind of give you a more general idea of what I'm going to be doing going forward, and in particular for next week. I am planning a special show that would be in addition to the normal weekly show. And it's in reference to an anniversary that is happening this month. It is, well, I'm not going to give too much of it away there, but let's just say that it's the anniversary of one of the more memorable characters in the entire history of professional wrestling. And coming up, I kind of keep a private playlist of things that I want to do coming up. There's an episode of Pro Wrestling USA from 1984 that has certainly caught my attention for the things that are on there. An episode of ECW. I'm trying to find the right ECW episode for me to do. There are some very early ones from 93 and 94. I was hoping that maybe I could get something later. And yes, I could go to the network for that. But again, you know, the whole purpose of this show was to kind of go off network a bit and do it that way. I also have a couple of AWA shows in the can here that'll be done at some point. And there's one particular episode of Tuesday Night Titans that I can't wait to get to. And if anybody had seen me comment on a certain post regarding Tuesday Night Titans at Facebook, I think you can figure out which one that would be. But for next week, I can tell you that I'm kind of going home. Maybe you could call it my safe space or whatever. Like I said, I'm a kid from the Northeast. I grew up on WWF. And home for me is 1991 WWF, during what I always call the mini Attitude Era, where they were doing all sorts of weird things that they hadn't tried before. And for this next episode, I'm going to be taking a look at Superstars from November 16th, 1991. And we got Hulk Hogan in the funeral parlor, who is rudely interrupted by Ric Flair, who is carrying the NWA title still, and it's not pixelated out. And that is a segment that, if you include The Undertaker, involves six Hall of Famers. Now, I'm not talking the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame, but, you know, I'm just going to talk in general the WWE Hall of Fame. I'm already putting Undertaker in there and including that to get the number to six. Oh, but there's more on that show. We get the debut of the Repo Man. Oh, so I can't wait to talk about Barry Darsow's spin as the Repo Man. All that and much more, and maybe YouTube Comment Theater will come back. I hope it does, because I really like playing that Austin Powers music underneath all that. But in any event, but do tune in next week for another exciting episode of Greetings from Allentown. Mm-hmm.